it's easy knowing that things are going to be hard like this to just shy away from doing the hard things. But if you don't, you'll never really improve. And you have to be, even though this stuff is hard, you have to be willing to really get into it and to do the hard thing. Otherwise, you're not really going to be an effective leader.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Jacob Kaplan-Moss. Jacob Kaplan-Moss is a veteran software leader and the co-creator of Django, the most widely used Python web framework. I built my last startup on Django, so speaking with him was a huge pleasure. In addition to authoring the book, The Definitive Guide to Django, Jacob has also led teams at 18F and Heroku. Today, Jacob is an expert on hiring for software teams that are in that adolescent phase between startup and scale-up. Today's episode is the first of a two-part interview that we did with Jacob. In today's interview, we discuss ways that you can reduce bias in your hiring process and how the Satir change model can help you navigate the challenges associated with rapid growth without losing your mind. I love both of these subjects, and this interview is my favorite I've done thus far. Jacob and I had a fantastic conversation, and it ran long. We're breaking this interview into two episodes because we packed so many valuable topics into our hour together. Without further ado, here is part one of my conversation with Jacob Kaplan-Moss. Jacob Kaplan-Moss, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Jacob, what's a career inflection point that got you to where you are today?
I think the biggest one was getting hired at the Lawrence Journal World in Kansas. I was living in New Jersey, kind of hating my job and the city, and took a flyer on moving to somewhere I'd never been, to Kansas, and joining a newspaper, which I'd never, you know, worked in journalism. It was a crash course in software engineering. I got to work with still two of the best engineers I've ever worked with, Simon Willison and Adrian Halavati, and learned so much working with them. And then about a year later, we open sourced Django, and that has proven to be, you know, successful beyond anything I could have possibly imagined, and definitely kind of lit a fire under my career in a way that not a lot else would have.
And did you find that job just on a job board? How did you end up in Kansas?
I saw it on either Simon or Adrian's blog, which I read pretty regularly. I sort of knew of them through the Python community, although I hadn't met either of them. It's a funny story. I saw the job and was so excited about it, sent an email off to Adrian, I think. And just a couple hours later, I was on the phone with their boss, Rob Curley, and we talked for a while. And then Curley was like, "Hey, we got to get you out to Kansas." And that was the first moment that I actually knew that it was in Kansas. I had just completely ignored that part.
Oh, nice.
I was in my excitement to go work with these guys. And I sort of covered and was like, "Oh yeah, of course. Let me look at my calendar." Cause I had just assumed it was in, you know, I was on a coast somewhere. I had just made it the easy assumption. I didn't even read the full post. But it was a good choice, and it worked out really well for me.
I appreciate the move because my first startup, we used Django, and Sweet. It benefited me greatly coming from PHP world. So I appreciate all your work.
That's where we all came from too. We were all PHP developers before that and looking for something better.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Maybe that's why it jived with me good. I was coming from it was that or Ruby at the time. And it was everyone's building cool stuff. Which one drives me emotionally? And I think it was the Django docs, I think, is what really did it for me. So you went to the Lawrence Journal World, and when did you start leading software teams?
Well, it sort of happened kind of gradually. After Adrian left the Journal World, I kind of by default became the senior engineer there. I wasn't really a manager at that point, although we weren't super formal about that stuff. So I was kind of responsible for sort of hiring and bringing on new people and overseeing them, but also not really explicitly. And frankly, I don't think I did a very good job as sort of a lead at that point, partially because I was still pretty immature in my own career, and partially because sort of there were never any clear expectations about what that meant. I think the point at which I really started paying attention to what it means to lead and to and to actually run things was after I started my consultancy, or rather joined my partner, Frank, who already had been a consultant for a while, joined him at RevSys and sort of started building that out, made our first hire there. We were leading teams comprised of us and of some engineers at our clients. And that's when I really started thinking much more seriously and systematically about what it meant to sort of be a leader and to be, you know, have that responsibility and to be effective, not just as someone writing code, but as someone facilitating other people writing code.
So kind of putting yourself back into that mindset, you know, you've kind of become the engineering manager by default. It's not explicit, and you have these extra careers. What are some things you wish you could tell yourself? Maybe you wouldn't listen, but what would you tell yourself about that transition to help make it easier?
You know, when I think back on most of the early hires I made, the people we hired at the Journal World, the people we hired at RevSys, in retrospect, at the time, I thought, man, we keep hiring these great people. I'm doing a really good job. In retrospect, I got lucky. You know, no slight against the people we hired. They're freaking amazing. But I was lucky to get them. There was some, I didn't have any sort of system or process. If they had been bad, I don't think I would have noticed during the sort of hiring process. I didn't have any sort of interviews worked out. I didn't think about how the questions in the interview might correlate to job performance. I think because we were this small organization in the middle of the country with no real cachet, we were lucky in the sense that people who wanted to work with us were people we by and large already knew, and so it was less risky to bring them on. But it could have ended very, very badly given the just complete lack of rigor that I put into that process. And so, yeah, if I could go back in time, I would say, you know, I would tell myself, like, you know, I've always been a systems thinker when it comes to software. Obviously, like, I helped build a freaking web framework, right? Like, I always think about, you know, not just solving the one problem, but kind of solving the meta problem. And I don't know why it took me so long to think about management and about hiring and about all of those things as systems rather than as these sort of ad hoc, one-off, you know, random processes.
I had a very similar experience. My first three hires were great. I thought I was awesome. Yeah. And then my fourth hire, I learned that I was getting lucky. And I think that systems thing, I think for me at least, it was, I didn't feel like it was the exciting part of my job. It was like the thing I had to do. Do you think that was your story, or was it just like not examining the hiring part?
I mean, I think that sort of early experience at the paper is pretty typical, where you have someone who becomes more senior. Maybe people leave. Maybe the team grows and you need someone in a lead position. But most organizations, I don't think, are super explicit about the parts, about like what that means to be a senior engineer, a team lead, a manager. And those things sort of get lumped on top of the engineering work. And it's really unclear what even to do. You know, if you had asked me a decade ago, like, what does an engineering manager do? I would have just kind of been like, write code, but then also tell other people to write code, which is totally different from my answer today. I would be able to lay out a whole bunch of specific tactics and activities that engineering managers do. But a lot of organizations don't teach that stuff. No one sits down and says, this is how you have a one-on-one. You know, no one sits down and says, here's how to give feedback. They just sort of like, if you're lucky, they tell you that giving feedback is part of your job. They probably don't even tell you that. And that was pretty typical. That was what my experience was early on in my career. Actually, not even early on. Like, I never got that sort of instruction from any organization I've ever worked at. Everything I know about that has come from reading or listening to other people or talking to peers, that sort of stuff. I've never had a manager who explicitly said, here is how to do this particular management task, in the same way that we might sit down with someone new at an organization and say, hey, here's how to use our CI system, for example. And that's been one of my goals in starting to write and talk about hiring specifically, because my experience has been that managers get told, hey, you need to hire someone, and that's it. They don't tell them how. They don't tell them what the steps look like. They don't give them any pointers. And so I've been trying to write as much of that down as I can so that people who are in their careers where I was a decade ago have something that they can look at and think about as they jump into that work.
So that kind of ties into the writing and consulting you're doing now. Could you tell us a little bit more about the consulting you're doing around hiring systems?
Yeah, this is a new thing and a bit of an experiment for me in kind of reviewing the type of consulting work that I really like and that I really enjoy. It keeps coming back to building those human systems, and specifically hiring and the types of related activities around hiring, job descriptions, career ladders, compensation, promotion, sort of all the stuff that is sort of tied or loosely connected to that has always been the things that I've enjoyed doing the most, both in my full-time jobs and as a consultant. And so I have some availability over the next, you know, year, 6 months, et cetera. And I think that I wanted to try to see if I could use that time to really focus in on that work and to work with organizations that need a hand, not to the point of needing to, you know, most organizations don't need someone whose full-time job it is to work on and think about this stuff. They grow in fits and starts and spurts, and hiring a full-time engineering hiring manager or something would be a rare thing to do, but bringing on someone for a more focused, specific engagement seems like a good thing. And the early results have been promising. I've had some cool organizations to work with, and I'm getting to focus on an area that I really like, and I think I can bring some value.
So what kind of companies are you looking to work with? Like, what's your kind of where you think you can help the most?
You know, my first few early clients, and then the work that I've done previously, has tended to center around organizations that have a fairly large hiring need. They don't just need to hire one or two people next year. They want to hire a dozen people. They want to hire two dozen people. And they recognize that having a repeatable process is going to be important for them. They're probably going to need multiple people to be executing sort of multiple simultaneous hiring lanes. They're going to need to be able to train people to participate. It's going to be an effort, and they want to make sure that they kind of have all their ducks in a row so that they make as effective hires as they want. So usually that means growing organizations, you know, organizations that have just got a bunch of funding, or, you know, teams within a larger group that have, you know, expanded their mandate. It could be different. You know, one of the reasons that I invested so much time in our hiring process at 18F when I was employed there wasn't because we were growing exactly. It was because 18F employees, this is a government agency, and we were all on term limited jobs. There's a maximum of 4 years under the hiring authority that we were using to bring that they still use to bring people in there. And so that means that hiring is kind of a continuous thing. You can't really assume that you'll hire and the team will stay stable. There's a constant rotation as people's terms expire and they leave. And so it was really important for us to really put together a really solid engineering hiring process so that would live beyond any individual person who stayed there, and ensure sort of a continuing level of quality, you know, ensure a constant bar even as the staff rotated in and out on their various, you know, tours of duty.
Every 4 years, at first I was thinking that's crazy, but then I've also read that most companies in the Valley have about a 2-year average tenure for engineers, so maybe not that crazy.
But, you know, keep in mind that's only something like 10% of software engineers work for like Silicon Valley companies. Like, when we talk about software engineering as a discipline, it's easy to think about the Facebooks, the Googles, and all the startups in the Valley. But the vast majority of software engineers are working for, you know, they're working for Cerner, you know, a huge healthcare company. They come to mind because I used to live in Kansas, you know, about 40 minutes from the Cerner campus, and they were just constantly hiring software engineers. No one really thinks about those people. They don't think about the, you know, hundreds of thousands of software engineers working in India and China. There's, when we talk about the Valley, it's really the tip of the iceberg, and we got to be pretty careful about trying to extrapolate to the entire industry based on this wacko town out on the West Coast.
It's a very loud wacko town.
It's very loud, and there's a ton of money, but it's not in many ways, it's not actually representative of what the bulk of the industry is doing and wants to do.
So thinking about the differences between hiring and that wacko 10% that gets a lot of attention and the other 90%, what do you think the kind of the differences are?
I think that there's a huge bias in the Bay Area, and I'm using that term loosely, not just to include companies literally in the Bay Area, but sort of companies in the VC investment, higher sort of that world. I think that there's a lot of cachet put on previous startup experience. Like if you've been a founder, that counts for a lot. And in my experience, no one really digs into how successful that company that you founded was. It's funny, you're interviewing someone for a job. So clearly the thing they founded didn't work out in some sense because they're not still working there. But it's rare to actually ask what happened or to ask in any sort of deep way. There's also a really large cachet put on the big companies, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google. And some of that I think is deserved. Those companies deal with problems on a very different scale from most organizations. You know, if you're dealing with scaling, you're dealing with scaling traffic and you have experience doing, you know, application engineering at Google at that scale. Yeah, that's experience you're really not going to get almost anywhere else. And it definitely speaks for a lot. But most people at Google aren't working on web traffic. Most people are working on, you know, some corner of the ads ecosystem, and they're not really doing much that's different from any other organization. And I think we overemphasize the value of experience at those organizations. Now, I'll say, you know, they're very attractive targets for employees, places people want to go work because their compensation is so great. And, you know, like, fine, you know, I would definitely, like, if being well compensated for your work is important, and I think it's important to most people, it's definitely worth targeting those organizations and trying to get hired there because, yeah, they do have, from what I've seen, compensation that's significantly better than almost anywhere else. But that doesn't necessarily mean from a hiring manager's point of view that seeing Google on someone's resume indicates very much about their experience.
Right. I definitely see. I mean, pedigree is easy to see, right? It's very visible, so it makes sense why we maybe overvalue it. So what's the alternative?
Like, you know, so there's been a practice in resume review of reviewing blind resumes where you take the person's name off the resume before you look at it. And I think that that's a good practice. There's research that shows that when managers evaluate a resume with a classically African-American name on it, they rate the experience lower than if they look at the exact same resume with a classically white name, same for women's resumes versus men's resumes. So looking at a resume blind with, you know, with the names taken off of it has, you know, we've seen some evidence that it reduces our own bias and enables us to make more valid and more sort of scientifically based decisions. It stands to reason that blinding the companies would tend to do the same. I could see a world where you have, you know, your recruiting partner or someone in the process before the hiring manager sees it goes in and replaces, you know, Apple with hardware manufacturer or something, you know, put some sort of generic tag to indicate the sector and the type of work, but removes any identifying characteristics so that you're, as a hiring manager, you're looking at the responsibilities and the accomplishments and not at the company. This is a hypothesis. I don't have any data here and I've not tried this, but it seems like something that it is something that I would like to try sometime.
So one, I like that idea. I'm interested in the experiment. The one kind of hiccup I have around the blinding, and I think that there's a lot to be gained from it, is I talk to hiring managers that say that they care a lot about gaps in resumes. And one of the common gaps for women is they had first child, second child, maybe they left the workforce. I worry about if you see a woman's name and you see a big gap, you're going to go right there. But I worry about things like that, where that name gives us some context to make a better decision. Feels like blinding might be a net good, but I'm not sure how we get the same good without losing some of the context. That's my, what do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, everything's a trade-off. You know, I've seen this discussion around, not just around hiring, but also around representation at software conferences. some conferences do blind reviews so that they are not biased in their selection of speakers. Other conferences want to know the speaker's background so that they can produce a lineup that's as diverse and interesting as possible. Other conferences try to kind of split the difference where they do an early review blind and then they unblind for the final review. Obviously, in a hiring context, like, it's pretty hard to do a job interview without making some inferences about a person's gender and race. You know, I'm looking at you over a video call right now, and I am a human being, so I'm making some assumptions about your race and gender. And it's going to be pretty dang hard not to do that and still have an effective job interview. I don't know how you would entirely take it out. So I think it's a matter of, as with everything in hiring, it's important to think about what the effect you're looking for is and what your priorities and what your goals are. And if it's really important to you to be able to sort of glean as much information from a candidate's resume, then yeah, knowing their demographic information on paper might be important. I don't think resumes are super useful. I review a resume, it takes me about 60 seconds, and I generally err towards interviewing more people. And in fact, I've worked with some organizations where when I look at the number of applications I have, I just say, why don't you just interview everyone? Like, your resume review is not really getting you much value. Just spend the time to interview everyone. So for me, I think removing bias at that point is probably the most important, because you are doing it super fast. And because it's the most error prone, given that you're looking at a piece of paper and trying to draw conclusions about someone's performance. So I want to remove as much bias at that point as possible. But yeah, like, you know, when it comes to something like understanding gaps in a candidate's work history, you know, knowing that they, you know, took time off to care for a kid or a family or, you know, a parent or something like that, you know, is important context versus took a year off because no one wanted to hire them.
Yeah, that I like what you said to start. It's about trade-offs, and we got to be conscious about our trade-offs.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were at Heroku when it was growing. You were at 18F while it was doing a lot of hiring. So thinking about those scaling challenges for your engineering team, what are some of the biggest challenges that you encountered?
When I look back on my career and sort of the organizations I've worked with, maybe over the last 8 or 10 years. There's a theme that emerges that a lot of these have been kind of what I might call like teenage organizations. They're not startups anymore, but they're not big and established. They're in that awkward middle phase where they've grown past the point where everyone knows everyone, but they haven't yet built the systems and processes that will take them from teenage to mature. You know, like when you're building software, Early on, traction is the only important thing. Like, it's useless to spend a bunch of time optimizing your hiring funnel if you only have funding to hire 3 people and you don't know where your next round is going to come from. Like, don't spend a ton of time coming up with a great interview guide and training for your managers, because if you don't hire people quickly, you probably won't be in business long enough for that stuff to be useful. And in the same way, like, it's useless to spend a bunch of time thinking about how you're going to serve, you know, billions of hits a day when you haven't launched your web app yet. Like, you're going to be lucky if that's the problem you have in a couple of years. But then a thing happens when you are successful and suddenly you need those systems and they don't exist. And I've been in a lot of organizations that are growing past that point where they've done the easy thing early on to get traction and they've got traction. And now they need, just as in their software, their human systems need things that are safe, that are repeatable, that are reliable, that produce good results, that are measurable, you know, well documented, all of that stuff. And all of that is a lot of change. I was at Heroku sort of towards the tail end of their transition away from a so-called flat organization to one with a more typical structure. And there was still a lot of uncertainty and resentment and fear and uncertainty around what it meant to move from everyone is a peer, everyone is equal, to now we have teams and structures and managers and directors and that sort of stuff. Change is hard and people dislike it. And it's all of the organizations I've worked with, the constant factor has been some fairly large changes while I was there. and they need to work through those changes and help people, you know, help people through them, help the organization through them.
What are some ways a leader, so let's say your organization is at that inflection point where you're splitting into multiple teams, you're adding management layers, people are, like you said, kind of uncertain about that change. How can a leader help smooth that process?
I'm a really big fan of, there's a model called the Satir change model, Virginia Satir. She wrote, I think she was a psychologist perhaps, and I think this was less around management and more around sort of, you know, humans and sort of natural change, but it's really guided a lot of how I think about organizational change. And her main observation was, you've got this system that's moving along at some status quo, and you're performing at some level. You know, you're at a 5 out of 10 on some whatever scale, and everyone's pretty happy with that. They know how it works, they know how everything runs, they know how it functions. But for whatever reason, you say, look, we need to be at a 7. We need to get our organization to a 7. And like a naive model would be like, you start at the 5 and you sort of ramp up and now you're at the 7 and it's a smooth increase and everyone's happy and things get better and you make this change gradually and you go from 5 to 5.5 to 6 to 6.5 to 7 and everyone's pretty happy.
Butterfly sunshine. Right.
That's not how change works. That's not actually what happens. What the Satir model has is you introduce this change, which immediately is followed by resistance and then what she calls chaos. And basically performance drops as everyone has to learn how to do new things and you suddenly drop. And so, you know, you're a flat organization and you're moving to structured. So you introduce some managers and instantly everyone's productivity drops because now there are more systems. Communication is different. It's not as peer-to-peer as it used to be. There are actual teams now. It's not, everyone doesn't get to work on what they want anymore. There are some trade-offs and negotiations around who gets to work on what. You have to come up with ways to prioritize. And suddenly everyone's productivity drops. And so if you take a sample a couple weeks after that change, everyone's going to go, what the heck? Like we screwed up. We made a bad change. We're way lower than we needed to.
We're at a 5. Now we're at a 4.5.
Now we're at a 4. Now we're at a 3. Now we're at a 0. I've seen organizations that, you know, introduce organizational change and literally all work grinds to a halt. And it's like, why did we do this? We can't get anything done anymore. And that's when, as a leader, you need to guide people through that. I've heard this referred to as the trough of despair. You've dropped down, you're in the muck, you can't figure out. And as a leader, you have to point to, we're going there. It's going to be better. And there's a combination of trust that you've built up over time. There's a combination, you have to be very deliberate about the changes you introduce because you know that they're going to cause this sort of temporary panic and disruption. You have to be realistic with everyone you talk to that, like, hey, when we make this change, things are going to get worse before they get better. You have to know that change takes some real time and energy and to give it space to make it happen. And you need to guide people through it. If you do this right, the second part of this change model is the sort of the integration and the new status quo. And that's when you see that performance increase and things get better and better and better until hopefully a year later you look back and you go, wow, that was kind of crazy after we introduced that change, but now we're at that 7. We're where we need to be. I have done this enough now that I think the right level of confidence to be able to say to people, like, I know this seems bad right now, but this is going to work out. And here's how it's going to work out. And here's what's going to work out. And here's what the next steps are going to look like. And so I think that would be the last kind of like piece of advice I would give to people looking to make changes in organizations is it's easy knowing that things are going to be hard like this to just shy away from doing the hard things. But if you don't, you'll never really improve. And you have to be, even though this stuff is hard, you have to be willing to really get into it and to do the hard thing. Otherwise, you're not really going to be an effective leader.
So it's set expectations that things are going to get a little bit worse. You hit the resistance phase, point to the top of the hill, and then help people not panic as you go through. Integration was the second phase?
Integration is the third phase. It's like status quo, resistance. Fourth, status quo, resistance, chaos.
Chaos.
Integration, and then the new status quo. Yeah.
I talk with a lot of startups, and there's lots of chaos out there.
There is lots of chaos. I think that's another point is that being deliberate about what changes you introduce and when. Like, I've seen a lot of organizations that they make some change and you know things fall off, and then you make another change and things fall off some more, and then you make another change and things fall off some more, and like giving it time to like giving a big change time to integrate and time for people to see that it's going to work out. You only get so many trust me's without showing results before people stop trusting you. So the way that you gain that, you know, the way that you gain that trust to say like, I know this sucks right now, but it's going to be better is by proving it. So like from a very practical standpoint, if I'm a new manager and I know I need to change 9 things, I'm going to pick one, and I'm probably going to pick a fairly easy one, and I'm going to do that first. And I'm going to get through that, and I'm not going to do new things. I'm not going to be needlessly reactive. I'm going to get through 1 or 2 fairly low-hanging fruit so that when I come to my team with something big, I have proven that I can actually get this stuff done, and I'm not just telling them to take it on faith.
So get some quick wins, some quick, you know, moving through the cycle to fill up your trust me.
There are other ways to build trust besides demonstrating results. If you're more senior in your career, you have a certain track record from other organizations that will follow you into a new career. If you are a technical expert and you're trying to make a technical change, there's a lot of trust that comes with your level of technical expertise. There are a variety of ways that you can build trust in organizations, but it's pretty much a prerequisite to having a successful change, because there is going to be that moment where things are worse than they were before and people say, why don't we just give up? And you have to be able to get people past that moment. I don't know any other way of doing it than people trusting you that you're leading them in the right direction.
This show is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help software teams hit ambitious hiring goals. We do that by improving the fuzziest step in the hiring process, candidate screening. By giving every candidate a fair chance to show what they can do, our customers find more great candidates and they back their decisions with evidence to remove bias. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your development team, check us out at woventeams.com. Thanks again to Jacob for sitting down with me to talk about his journey. We'll be back next Monday with the second half of this interview, so stay tuned and keep an eye on our blog at woventeams.com/blog for more content from Jacob. In the meantime, here are my top takeaways from today's conversation. Hiring bias has existed about as long as hiring has existed. While we give a lot of lip service to increasing diversity in the workplace, a Harvard study published in 2017 showed that the progress we've made on racial discrimination in particular over the past 25 years has been negligible. What's worse is that the usual suspects aren't doing much to solve the problem. Algorithms and machine learning are, in many cases, increasing biases in hiring, including one infamous example where a resume screening intern learned a preference for men named Jared who play lacrosse. The solution requires making foundational changes to your hiring process and de-emphasizing traditional but highly flawed heuristics, like resumes and credentials. But these changes aren't easy. In fact, change done well can disrupt your team in the short term and decrease productivity, which is why he emphasizes that the Satir change model is a vehicle to overcome the chaos that comes with that rapid growth and change. It allows you to avoid shying away from those hard decisions. Personally, I gained some great insights from this conversation that I'm planning on implementing with my team, but I want to know what you've learned and what you want to learn more about. Email me at wes@woventeams.com or tweet me at Wes Winham. I read every response and I'd love to hear from you. I'm excited to learn along this journey with you, and I'm always looking for your feedback about how to make the show better. If you have anyone you think I should interview, tweet me at Wes Winham or at @woven_teams and I'll reach out. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll see you next Monday.